Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel C1. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Speaker 1.
Apprenticeship. I mean, I was writing at a very young age. My mother gave me notebooks and she said, write down what you did today, and so I would. And I just thought in terms of sentences, and I knew that I was a writer from a very, very young age. Well, I actually wanted to be a writer since I was about 4. And then I just couldn't get it right to convey what I needed to convey to the reader. Couldn't do it until
As people
finally,
say in your prose, I mean, nothing is wasted.
Right. When I wrote My Name is Lucy Barton, I made it particularly porous in a way because I want readers to bring their own life experiences to my books. And they will. I mean, you will bring your own life experience to every book you read. But the more that's written, then the more difficult it is, I think, for a reader to enter into the text itself. And I love the city, but I do think that there are people in New York City who do feel a sense of repulsion for the truly provincial. And so there's dress is a very distinctive way of letting people know that you're not really from the city. You know, my daughter told me, Mom, you can't wear pink anymore. And my friend, who was also raised in New York City, said, she's just trying to urbanize you. You know, it's so interesting because a number of years ago, I did realize that New Yorkers were provincial in their own way. And they are, because they think that the way they think is the only way to think. And isn't that what we would think of as provincial?
Speaker 2.
My second novel, I remember a friend actually confronting me, saying, aren't you an English teacher? Why are you writing it in this voice? And then when I sent the book out, the first publisher asked me to rewrite it in a sort of Jane Austen English. We're not friends anymore. But the idea that everybody has that person chats bad and I speak proper, and the whole notion of proper English, what that is something that I think hovers over Jamaican speech quite a bit. Our proper English is a very dead form of English. And language can fool you. For example, just because of the way I speak, most Jamaicans assumed I was rich. Right. You assume I was an uptown Jamaican, that I was rich. Your skin kind of black, but you must be uptown.
Yeah.
because I sound proper. I'm like, no, I sound like I watch too much Sesame Street. That's what I sound like. Because I'm surrounded by, you know, by all these books and have a dad who keeps spouting soliloquies and Wordsworth and Coleridge. Always being surrounded by language and rhythm and so on. And eventually I got hooked on Shakespeare.
Speak at 3.
You couldn't read or write until you were 9.
Well, let's say,
why were you such a slow... Okay, 8, I beg your pardon. Why were you such a slow starter?
I think I came out of the starting blocks at great speed. But the speed wasn't anything to do with reading or writing. It was to do with loving my family. I was so busy, I think, for those 8 years, worshipping them and adoring them, that I didn't think I needed to go on to the dark arts of writing and reading. They were in themselves books. And indeed, I have spent the following 50 years trying to prove that to myself. I think I understood language not as this rather recent technique of writing something written down, but like in those Rowlandson cartoons of the 18th century where you saw there's a ticker tape and the talk is in the tape. It seems like something visible to me. And not only that, but the particular phrases and cornucopia of memory of individual members of my family, like my great aunt Annie, for me, represented her. It was an alternative version of her. And because of that, when the day comes, inevitably, with these the older people in the generations ahead of you die, you can bring them with you in this kit form of floating language. And I think in those 8 years, my whole work as a novelist at the age of 6, 7, and 8 was to learn the university of that and not worry about anything else. And I have to say, all credit to my mother and father, they didn't bat an eyelid. Maybe they weren't paying a huge amount of attention, so that's not so good. But no one ever mentioned dyslexia or anything like that. When I went back...
Dispone ahora de 1 minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Speaker 1.
Apprenticeship. I mean, I was writing at a very young age. My mother gave me notebooks and she said, write down what you did today, and so I would. And I just thought in terms of sentences, and I knew that I was a writer from a very, very young age. Well, I actually wanted to be a writer since I was about 4. And then I just couldn't get it right to convey what I needed to convey to the reader. Couldn't do it until...
As people
finally...
say in your prose, I mean, nothing is wasted.
Right. When I wrote My Name is Lucy Barton, I made it particularly porous in a way because I want readers to bring their own life experiences to my books. And they will. I mean, you will bring your own life experience to every book you read. But the more that's written, then the more... difficult it is, I think, for a reader to enter into the text itself. And I love the city, but I do think that there are people in New York City who do feel a sense of repulsion for the truly provincial. And so there's dress is a very distinctive way of letting people know that you're not really from the city. You know, my daughter told me, Mom, you can't wear pink anymore. And my friend, who was also raised in New York City, said, she's just trying to urbanize you. You know, it's so interesting because a number of years ago, I did realize that New Yorkers were provincial in their own way. And they are, because they think that the way they think is the only way to think. And isn't that what we would think of as provincial?
Speaker 2.
My second novel, I remember a friend actually confronting me saying, aren't you an English teacher? Why are you writing it in this voice? And then when I sent the book out, the first publisher asked me to rewrite it in a sort of Jane Austen English. We're not friends anymore. But the idea that everybody has that person chats bad and I speak proper, and the whole notion of proper English, what that is something that I think hovers over Jamaican speech quite a bit. Our proper English is a very dead form of English. And language can fool you. For example, just because of the way I speak, most Jamaicans assumed I was rich. Right. You assume I was an uptown Jamaican, that I was rich. Your skin kind of black, but you must be uptown.
Yeah.
because I sound proper. I'm like, no, I sound like I watch too much Sesame Street. That's what I sound like. Because I'm surrounded by, you know, by all these books and have a dad who keeps spouting soliloquies and Wordsworth and Coleridge. Always been surrounded by language and rhythm and so on. And eventually I got hooked on Shakespeare.
Speak at 3.
You couldn't read or write until you were 9.
Well,
Why were you such a slow... Okay, 8. I beg your pardon. Why were you such a slow starter?
I think I came out of the starting blocks at great speed. But the speed wasn't anything to do with reading or writing. It was to do with loving my family. I was so busy, I think, for those 8 years, worshipping them and adoring them, that I didn't think I needed to go on to the dark arts of writing and reading. They were in themselves books. And indeed, I have spent the following 50 years trying to prove that to myself. I think I understood language not as this rather recent technique of writing something written down, but like in those Rowlandson cartoons of the 18th century where you saw there's a ticker tape and the talk is in the tape. It seems like something visible to me. And not only that, but the particular phrases and cornucopia of memory of individual members of my family, like my great aunt Annie, for me, represented her. It was an alternative version of her. And because of that, when the day comes, inevitably, with these the older people in the generations ahead of you die, you can bring them with you in this kit form of floating language. And I think in those 8 years, my whole work as a novelist at the age of 6, 7, and 8 was to learn the university of that and not worry about anything else. And I have to say, all credit to my mother and father, they didn't bat an eyelid. Maybe they weren't paying a huge amount of attention, so that's not so good. But no one ever mentioned dyslexia or anything like that. When I went back...
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Speaker 1.
Apprenticeship. I mean, I was writing at a very young age. My mother gave me notebooks and she said, write down what you did today, and so I would. And I just thought in terms of sentences, and I knew that I was a writer from a very, very young age. Well, I actually wanted to be a writer since I was about 4. And then I just couldn't get it right to convey what I needed to convey to the reader. Couldn't do it until
say in your prose, I mean, nothing is wasted.
Right. When I wrote My Name is Lucy Barton, I made it particularly porous in a way because I want readers to bring their own life experiences to my books. And they will. I mean, you will bring your own life experience to every book you read. But the more that's written, then the more difficult it is, I think, for a reader to enter into the text itself. And I love the city, but I do think that there are people in New York City who do feel a sense of repulsion for the truly provincial. And so there's dress is a very distinctive way of letting people know that you're not really from the city. You know, my daughter told me, "Mom, you can't wear pink anymore." And my friend, who was also raised in New York City, said, "She's just trying to urbanize you." You know, it's so interesting because a number of years ago, I did realize that New Yorkers were provincial in their own way. And they are, because they think that the way they think is the only way to think. And isn't that what we would think of as provincial?
Speaker 2.
My second novel, I remember a friend actually confronting me saying, "Aren't you an English teacher? Why are you writing it in this voice?" And then when I sent the book out, the first publisher asked me to rewrite it in a sort of Jane Austen English. We're not friends anymore. But the idea that everybody has that person chats bad and I speak proper, and the whole notion of proper English, what that is something that I think hovers over Jamaican speech quite a bit. Our proper English is a very dead form of English. And language can fool you. For example, just because of the way I speak, most Jamaicans assumed I was rich. Right. You assume I was an uptown Jamaican, that I was rich. Your skin kind of black, but you must be uptown.
Yeah.
Because I sound proper. I'm like, no, I sound like I watch too much Sesame Street. That's what I sound like. Because I'm surrounded by, you know, by all these books and have a dad who keeps spouting soliloquies and Wordsworth and Coleridge, always being surrounded by language and rhythm and so on, and eventually I got hooked on Shakespeare.
Speaker 3.
You couldn't read or write until you were 9.
Well,
why were you such a slow... Okay, 8, I beg your pardon. Why were you such a slow starter?
I think I came out of the starting blocks at great speed. But the speed wasn't anything to do with reading or writing. It was to do with loving my family. I was so busy, I think, for those 8 years, worshipping them and adoring them, that I didn't think I needed to go on to the dark arts of writing and reading. They were in themselves books. And indeed, I have spent the following 50 years trying to prove that to myself. I think I understood language not as this rather recent technique of writing something written down, but like in those Rowlandson cartoons of the 18th century where you saw there's a ticker tape and the talk is in the tape. It seems like something visible to me. And not only that, but the particular phrases and cornucopia of memory of individual members of my family, like my great-aunt Annie, for me, represented her. It was an alternative version of her. And because of that, when the day comes, inevitably, with these the older people in the generations ahead of you die, you can bring them with you in this kit form of floating language. And I think in those 8 years, my whole work as a novelist at the age of 6, 7, and 8 was to learn the university of that and not worry about anything else. And I have to say, all credit to my mother and father, they didn't bat an eyelid. Maybe they weren't paying a huge amount of attention, so that's not so good. But no one ever mentioned dyslexia or anything like that. When I went back...
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
Hey, Kai. I'm great. And I bet you just can't wait to see the new unemployment numbers on Friday. That's kind of like catnip for you.
That makes my day, pal. Come on. I live for that stuff.
Let me say this. Whatever the numbers say on Friday, the general picture is pretty clear, which is that unemployment remains relatively high. Everyone has, you know, a pet theory. But I'm here to tell you today about a trio of economists who have a new research paper out with a pretty interesting angle to explain the unemployment.
Three economists, three times as much fun, doesn't it? What do you got?
All right, let's start with something that we know to be true, okay? That on average, the more education you get, the better you do in the labor market. There's no question about that, right?
Yeah, it's ROE, baby. It's return on education, much like return on investment.
Exactly right. And that's thought to be especially true for what are called knowledge workers, which are people who primarily use their brains for their job, managers and tech jobs, things like that. But one author of this new paper, his name is Paul Beaudry, looked at 30 years worth of hiring data, and he found that demand for knowledge workers actually stopped growing quite a while ago.
But then you start noticing it's plateaued in 2000, even though more and more people are getting educated. It should have kept on going.
So, Dubner, you know 2000 was like 13 years ago, right? That's before the recession, the whole deal. What happened?
Well, what happened is the tech boom. In the 1990s, the tech boom led to much higher demand for knowledge workers. So more and more people started getting the appropriate college degrees. But in 2000, remember, we had the tech bust, which meant that that demand for knowledge jobs fell fast. Beaudry and his colleagues actually call it the Great Reversal.
So wait, Dubner, let me try this one more time. 2000 was 13 years ago, man. Make this make sense in the unemployment situation today.
Here's the thing. All those highly educated workers who educated themselves up from what was supposed to be the everlasting tech boom, they didn't get jobs that they thought, but those workers don't go away, okay? And then there are new graduates in the pipeline every year, but there still aren't enough high-end jobs to suit them. So what happens? Well, here's Paul Beaudry again.
These educated people aren't getting their jobs in that sector. They must be pushing down. And that's when we started noticing all this cascading. You know, I wouldn't want to kind of exaggerate. It's not like everyone's kind of getting a barista job, but that's exactly the feeling, is kind of like this pushing down.
So that's a pretty word that he uses, cascading, to describe a pretty ugly effect. Too many highly educated workers aren't able to find the jobs they're expecting, and as a result, they get shoved down the labor ladder a couple of rungs. Here's a fellow named Clayton Thomas. He's a software consultant in Salt Lake City. When he graduated from Duke a few years back, he studied life sciences. He was expecting to have no trouble finding a good research job.
And I went to job fairs where I would discuss openings with companies, and I found that I was competing with people that had master's degrees, even PhDs, for basically entry-level positions, which was pretty scary.
All right, so Dubner, what's that saying? I heard it in the service a lot. Stuff, shall we say, rolls downhill, right? I mean, what happens to the people on the bottom rungs of those ladders then?
Exactly right. As the top pushes the middle, the middle pushes the bottom, the crowding at the top pushes everybody down. But, you know, let me stay on the top for a minute. As much as we hear about needing to educate more STEM workers, STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, there's another new research paper out which argues that there is, in fact, no shortage of STEM workers, and that only half of U.S. STEM graduates end up with a STEM job already.
This is the most depressed you have ever made me, my friend. There must be some silver lining here. You got to hit me with that.
Let me try. If you go back several decades, you'll find that a huge share of the college-educated women in the U.S. labor force worked as school teachers, right? So even though the job didn't pay that well, a lot of the best and brightest women in the country were teachers because they didn't have as many opportunities as they do now. Mm-hmm. When the feminist revolution opened up those opportunities, it was great news for women who became doctors and lawyers and radio show hosts, on and on.
That's right.
But bad news for the classrooms. Well, See what you think of this idea.
All right.
This cascading.
Is this the hidden side? Is that where we're going?
This is so hidden. This is so hidden.
All right.
This cascading that we're seeing now with the top pushing down, what it means is that it might be good news for a field like education, because more and more highly educated people, women and men, could end up working as, say, teachers or elsewhere in education. So this year, for instance, Teach for America, which recruits from elite college campuses, had the most applications in its 20-year history. It accepted only 17% of the applicants, which means that on some campuses, it's almost as hard to get into Teach for America as it was to get into the college itself. So if selectivity is any measure, that means that the core of potential teachers, at least, is drawn from a very, very talented pool.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
Hey, Kai, I'm great. And I bet you just can't wait to see the new unemployment numbers on Friday. That's kind of like catnip for you.
It makes my day, pal. Come on, I live for that stuff.
Let me say this. Whatever the numbers say on Friday, the general picture is pretty clear, which is that unemployment remains relatively high. Everyone has, you know, a pet theory. But I'm here to tell you today about a trio of economists who have a new research paper out with a pretty interesting angle to explain the unemployment.
Three economists, three times as much fun, doesn't it? What do you got?
All right, let's start with something that we know to be true, okay? That on average, the more education you get, the better you do in the labor market. There's no question about that, right?
Yeah, it's ROE, baby. It's return on education, much like return on investment.
Exactly right. And that's thought to be especially true for what are called knowledge workers, which are people who primarily use their brains for their job, managers and tech jobs, things like that. But one author of this new paper, his name is Paul Beaudry, looked at 30 years worth of hiring data, and he found that demand for knowledge workers actually stopped growing quite a while ago.
But then you start noticing it's plateaued in 2000, even though more and more people are getting educated. It should have kept on going.
So, Dubner, you know 2000 was like 13 years ago, right? That's before the recession, the whole deal. What happened?
Well, what happened is the tech boom. In the 1990s, the tech boom led to much higher demand for knowledge workers. So more and more people started getting the appropriate college degrees. But in 2000, remember, we had the tech bust, which meant that that demand for knowledge jobs fell fast. Beaudry and his colleagues actually call it the Great Reversal.
So wait, Dubner, let me try this one more time. 2000 was 13 years ago, man. Make this make sense in the unemployment situation today.
Here's the thing. All those highly educated workers who educated themselves up from what was supposed to be the everlasting tech boom, they didn't get jobs that they thought, but yeah. Those workers don't go away, okay? And then there are new graduates in the pipeline every year, but there still aren't enough high-end jobs to suit them. So what happens? Well, here's Paul Beaudry again.
These educated people aren't getting their jobs in that sector. They must be pushing down. And that's when we started noticing all this cascading. You know, I wouldn't want to kind of exaggerate. It's not like everyone's kind of getting a barista job, but that's exactly the feeling. It's kind of like this pushing down.
So that's a pretty word that he uses, cascading, to describe a pretty ugly effect. Too many highly educated workers aren't able to find the jobs they're expecting. And as a result, they get shoved down the labor ladder a couple of rungs. Here's a fellow named Clayton Thomas. He's a software consultant in Salt Lake City. When he graduated from Duke a few years back, he studied life sciences. He was expecting to have no trouble finding a good research job.
And I went to job fairs where I would discuss openings with companies, and I found that I was competing with people that had master's degrees, even PhDs, for basically entry-level positions, which was pretty scary.
All right, so Dubner, what's that saying? I heard it in the service a lot. Stuff, shall we say, rolls downhill, right? I mean, what happens to the people on the bottom rungs of those ladders then?
Exactly right. As the top pushes the middle, the middle pushes the bottom, the crowding at the top pushes everybody down. But, you know, let me stay on the top for a minute. As much as we hear about needing to educate more STEM workers, STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, there's another new research paper out which argues that there is, in fact, no shortage of STEM workers, and that only half of U.S. STEM graduates end up with a STEM job already.
This is the most depressed you have ever made me, my friend. There must be some silver lining here. You got to hit me with that.
Let me try. If you go back several decades, you'll find that a huge share of the college-educated women in the U.S. labor force worked as school teachers, right? So even though the job didn't pay that well, a lot of the best and brightest women in the country were teachers because they didn't have as many opportunities as they do now. Mm-hmm. When the feminist revolution opened up those opportunities, it was great news for women who became doctors and lawyers and radio show hosts, mm-hmm. on and on.
That's right.
But bad news for the classrooms, well... See what you think of this idea.
All right.
This cascading.
Is this the hidden side? Is that where we're going?
This is so hidden. This cascading that we're seeing now with the top pushing down, what it means is that it might be good news for a field like education, because more and more highly educated people, women and men, could end up working as, say, teachers or elsewhere in education. So this year, for instance, Teach for America, which recruits from elite college campuses, had the most applications in its 20-year history. It accepted only 17% of the applicants, which means that on some campuses, it's almost as hard to get into Teach for America as it was to get into the college itself. So if selectivity is any measure, that means that the core of potential teachers, at least, is drawn from a very, very talented pool.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
Hey, Kai. I'm great. And I bet you just can't wait to see the new unemployment numbers on Friday. That's kind of like catnip for you.
It makes my day, pal. Come on. I live for that stuff.
Let me say this. Whatever the numbers say on Friday, the general picture is pretty clear, which is that unemployment remains relatively high. Everyone has, you know, a pet theory. But I'm here to tell you today about a trio of economists who have a new research paper out with a pretty interesting angle to explain the unemployment.
Three economists, three times as much fun, doesn't it? What do you got?
All right, let's start with something that we know to be true, okay? That on average, the more education you get, the better you do in the labor market. There's no question about that, right?
Yeah, it's ROE, baby. It's return on education, much like return on investment.
Exactly right. And that's thought to be especially true for what are called knowledge workers, which are people who primarily use their brains for their job, managers and tech jobs, things like that. But one author of this new paper, his name is Paul Beaudry, looked at 30 years worth of hiring data, and he found that demand for knowledge workers actually stopped growing quite a while ago.
But then you start noticing it's plateaued in 2000, even though more and more people are getting educated. It should have kept on going.
So, Dubner, you know 2000 was like 13 years ago, right? That's before the recession, the whole deal. What happened?
Well, what happened is the tech boom. In the 1990s, the tech boom led to much higher demand for knowledge workers. So more and more people started getting the appropriate college degrees. But in 2000, remember, we had the tech bust, which meant that that demand for knowledge jobs fell fast. Beaudry and his colleagues actually call it the Great Reversal.
So wait, Dubner, let me try this one more time. 2000 was 13 years ago, man. Make this make sense in the unemployment situation today.
Here's the thing. All those highly educated workers who educated themselves up from what was supposed to be the everlasting tech boom, they didn't get jobs that they thought, but those workers don't go away, okay? And then there are new graduates in the pipeline every year, but there still aren't enough high-end jobs to suit them. So what happens? Well, here's Paul Beaudry again.
These educated people aren't getting their jobs in that sector, they must be pushing down. And that's when we started noticing all this cascading. You know, I wouldn't want to kind of exaggerate. It's not like everyone's kind of getting a barista job, but that's exactly the feeling. It's kind of like this pushing down.
So that's a pretty word that he uses, cascading, to describe a pretty ugly effect. Too many highly educated workers aren't able to find the jobs they're expecting, and as a result, they get shoved down the labor ladder a couple of rungs. Here's a fellow named Clayton Thomas. He's a software consultant in Salt Lake City. When he graduated from Duke a few years back, he studied life sciences. He was expecting to have no trouble finding a good research job.
And I went to job fairs where I would discuss openings with companies, and I found that I was competing with people that had master's degrees, even PhDs, for basically entry-level positions, which was pretty scary.
All right, so Dubner, what's that saying? I heard it in the service a lot. Stuff, shall we say, rolls downhill, right? I mean, what happens to the people on the bottom rungs of those ladders then?
Exactly right. As the top pushes the middle, the middle pushes the bottom, the crowding at the top pushes everybody down. But, you know, let me stay on the top for a minute. As much as we hear about needing to educate more STEM workers, STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, there's another new research paper out which argues that there is, in fact, no shortage of STEM workers, and that only half of U.S. STEM graduates end up with a STEM job already.
This is the most depressed you have ever made me, my friend. There must be some silver lining here. You got to hit me with that.
Let me try. If you go back several decades, you'll find that a huge share of the college-educated women in the U.S. labor force worked as school teachers, right? So even though the job didn't pay that well, a lot of the best and brightest women in the country were teachers because they didn't have as many opportunities as they do now. Mm-hmm. When the feminist revolution opened up those opportunities, it was great news for women who became doctors and lawyers and radio show hosts, on and on.
That's right.
But bad news for the classrooms, well, See what you think of this idea.
All right.
This cascading.
Is this the hidden side? Is that where we're going?
This is so hidden. This cascading that we're seeing now with the top pushing down, what it means is that it might be good news for a field like education, because more and more highly educated people, women and men, could end up working as, say, teachers or elsewhere in education. So this year, for instance, Teach for America, which recruits from elite college campuses, had the most applications in its 20-year history. It accepted only 17% of the applicants, which means that on some campuses, it's almost as hard to get into Teach for America as it was to get into the college itself. So if selectivity is any measure, that means that the core of potential teachers, at least, is drawn from a very, very talented pool.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.